since we had skipped a week or two, that we would go back and do a quick review of what we've gone over so far. We'll review chapters 1 through 24 just very briefly. And the book of Ezekiel covers a 22 years period. It starts out 6 years before.
Recording in progress.
Thank you. About 6 years before Jerusalem actually fell, and then 16 years later. As we know from our study in chapter 1, Ezekiel is 30 years old when he begins his prophecies, and he prophesies for 22 years. At least that's the time frame that we're given. He may have continued his prophecies, but we are not told that that's the case. And that 22-year period is the ones that we have to study. He's living in exile in Babylon. He's been there for 5 years. He's part of the second exportation from Jerusalem. If you'll remember, Daniel and his cohorts were in the first Exodus, and now he is in the second one. He is contemporary with Daniel, also Jeremiah, that we studied not long ago with Ted, and Habakkuk also is in there. Ezekiel's commission was to be sent to a rebellious people. Jeremiah says in chapter 3 of his book that they have always sinned. Ezekiel also repeats that in chapter 20 of the book of Ezekiel. 2 Kings, the 17th chapter, says that the sin was the reason for their exile. We know that Ezekiel did odd things in the presence of others. Some of it he did out in the open during the day, others at nighttime. But he did in the presence of others. And when he was asked about what he was doing, then he would explain what he was doing to the others so that they would understand that he was, I can't say play acting, but that he was acting out what was going to transpire or what was transpiring. Remember that these people are in Babylon. They're about 300 miles north of Jerusalem. And so they're a little bit out of touch with people. Jerusalem is being besieged. So there's not many people that are able to get in or out at that particular time. They don't have a whole lot of information coming out of Jerusalem to keep them apprised of what is happening there. And so Ezekiel does these things and then explains what they mean to the people when he is asked. The purpose of God's word in Ezekiel is that they shall know that I am God. And this phrase that they shall know that I am God appears 62 times in the book of Ezekiel. That's a bunch. God is also dashing any hope among the Jews that that the captivity might be short. He's also using this to prove his case against Israel, to cause repentance, and to give hope. And so those things God is trying to impart to these people. Whether or not they understand or choose to understand is going to be left up to them. But God knows their hearts, even though they are professing to come to him and ask for information from him. He knows about their idols and the idol worship that they have in their heart. Ezekiel begins his prophesying with a description of God's all-seeing power when he describes a vision of the wheel. In it depicts God's power in seeing in all directions, going in all directions. It shows that God is not static in one place like the temple in Jerusalem, but his presence everywhere. So he sees all, goes everywhere he wants, and is not limited to his temple in Jerusalem. And we'll see a little bit later in Ezekiel where he is going to be in a vision. He is going to be transported to the temple in Jerusalem, and he's going to see God depart from that. This description of this prophecy in this sight, this vision that Ezekiel sees, it shows God is coming in a storm, as a storm cloud from the north, and that because of the situation or the site where Jerusalem and Judah is, that's the usual direction of invading armies, where they came from, basically from the north. I think this shows the impending calamity that's about to unfold on Israel. God's presence is seen as a storm cloud. And we find reference to this in God's presence on Mount Sinai in the fourth chapter of Deuteronomy, I believe. Psalms also, when 104 tells us that God traveled and travels on the clouds. We are also in our time given, we read in Matthew 24 that Jesus is described as coming on the clouds. So the clouds is quite a common thing to use when God is talking. Ezekiel is to act out on several occasions the coming destruction of Jerusalem and the surrounding area, and the destruction of everyone associated with Jerusalem in one form or another. What I mean by destruction is a lot of them are going to die by the sword. A lot of them are going to die by pestilence, starvation. There's going to be a few of them that are going to survive. I like to think that those were probably the ones that were more faithful than others. But we're not told that. Anyway, there are a few that do survive. Those that do survive end up being sent either as slaves and sold as slaves. Some are being sent and end up in Babylon along with Ezekiel and all the others that are there. The siege of Jerusalem lasted for some time, long enough to be for that famine to be so severe that family members resorted to cannibalism and ate each other. Because of the defilement of the temple, God demonstrates his removing himself to the Mount of Olives, and he's not going to have pity on Israel. And Ezekiel saw this in a vision when he was transported to Jerusalem, to the temple, and he saw God's spirit leave and go to the Mount of Olives. God also had Ezekiel prophesy against the mountains of Israel. And the reason he did that was because of the idols set up under every tree and on the top of every hill. People completely were so bad and so sinful. They even had deities set up in the temple itself. If you recall, and I think this is probably where the bulk of the problem came from, you remember Manasseh, who was Hezekiah's son. And when Hezekiah died, of course, him being a faithful follower of God, he died. His son Manasseh took over, and he was a very young man when he took over, and he reigned for 55 years and said that he did everything imaginable when it came to abomination. He set up the deities in the temple itself, profaned the temple, even burnt his own son in sacrifice to the deities. So he introduced almost every kind of thing that imaginable that would be in opposition to what God wanted. It was so bad that it made the surrounding countries absolutely amazed at how bad it became. Well, anyway, right after Manasseh, I think there was one of his sons ruled for a short time, like 2 years, something like that. And then Josiah shows up. And young man, he was absolutely appalled at what had transpired from his grandfather. And he tried to set it right, did what he could. But I think that the people in Judah, people of Israel, had 50 years plus to have had this drummed into their lives. It became a normal routine thing. And I think that they just hung on to that. Now, we all know that, you know, in studying the history of the Jews, they always had idols. They brought them out of Egypt when they exited Egypt. And they always, that was a thorn in the leaders, whether it be Moses, Joshua, Judges. They all went down through the years. They always had their idols. And Manasseh, of course, just made it that much worse. And then, of course, after Josiah, we never had another righteous king that came up, and it quickly went into its final fall. We learned about the destiny of Zedekiah, who was the last king of Judah, and how he was appointed by King Nebuchadnezzar, and how he pledged loyalty and then conspired with Egypt. And this probably was the main reason why Nebuchadnezzar caused him to viciously attack Jerusalem and not show any mercy at all. Zedekiah was 21 when he became the king. Excuse me. Can I get a glass of water? Thank you. He was 21 when he became king in Judah, and he ruled for 11 years. And he, of course, did everything that he shouldn't have done. So he just compounded the problem. We read about Nebuchadnezzar having a choice between attacking Judah or attacking Ammon and Moab, and he read the tea leaves, so to speak, and the palms and all that stuff, and
thanks, man.
And the calf's liver, and he decided that, well, he was going to attack Jerusalem, and so that's what has happened. And because of Zedekiah's treachery, I think this is why he chose to march on Jerusalem and show no mercy at all. And you remember that he was, a long time in setting up battering rams and siege towers and whatnot like this. He finally made a breach in the wall. And when he did this, Zedekiah and his princes and his family and all that stuff, they hit, they took off, went through a gate at nighttime and headed out down to the Jericho. And that was when he was taken captive by the Chaldeans. And he was 11 years, he was 21. He ruled 11 years, so he was 32 years old when he was taken captive. And he was marched off to Riblah, I think, where Nebuchadnezzar was sitting at the time. And so being 32 years old, he's a rather young man still. and so his children couldn't have been more than a few years old, 8, 9, 10 maybe. Nebuchadnezzar had them slaughtered in front of him, and then had Zedekiah's eyes put out. After that, he was marched off to Babylon, and where he died. And Jerusalem was then totally destroyed. It says that they made a breach in the wall. They went through there. It took them a month of ransacking to get everything that they wanted to get out of the city of Jerusalem. And then the city was burned. And they started with the rich people and the palace, burned it, and then, of course, stripped everything out of the temple and hauled it off to Babylon. So now we're in chapter 25. That kind of covers a brief history of chapters 1 through 24. If you'd like to unmute and have any comments up to now, have at it. You mean I did that so good nobody has any questions or comments? Okay, so then we go to chapter 25. And here now God turns his wrath on the surrounding countries. And one of the reasons why he does this is that they were evil and wicked in their own right. They all had one thing in common, and that was their hatred of Israel. and they rejoiced greatly. They were thrilled to death when Israel and the temple were destroyed. We find out a little bit later that one of the reasons why is these people, everything that came out of those countries had to come through Judah on the way to Tyre. And we'll find out that Tyre was the big shipping center, not only receiving but also shipping things from all over that part of the world. And it all came through Jerusalem and the country of Judah, and they had a poll tax. So they were having to pay these taxes before they could go through that area. But they had a long history of warfare, jealousy, and so they just had a common thing, and that was their hatred of Israel. The Ammonites, they were northeast of Judah, across the Jordan River. They were descendants of Lot. They eventually were destroyed by the Arabs, and they disappeared into history. The Moabites were south of there, and they were to the east side of the Jordan River and east of Israel. They were also descendants of Lot. And they, at the time that the Ammonites were destroyed by the Arabs, the Moabites also were destroyed by the Arabs, and they disappeared into history as well. And we'll find that a little bit later on that Nebuchadnezzar, while he used these Ammonites and Moab to defeat Judah, he now has employed the Arabs to destroy the Ammonites and Moab. The Edomites, they were southeast and south of Judah. They were descendants of Esau. Now, all of these people, Ammon, Moab, Edom, they were all relatives, cousins, whatnot, of the Jews, but that didn't stop them from the hatred. But the Edomites, they came and went, but they eventually disappeared into history forever as well. they still dig up things from time to time that relate to these different countries. The archaeologist so forth dig something up that refers to something or other. So we know that these countries existed not only because the Bible tells us, but they do dig evidence up from time to time to justify that belief. So we know it's true, but others may have some question about it. The Philistines, who lived on the coast area, had five main kings that they had. Five, they were kind of like city-states, all each had their kings, but they were kind of a group of kings, and their they had the same problem. They always had problems with Israel, constantly doing battles. We've seen this all up and down through the Old Testament history about the Philistines. They were people from Crete. They were kind of seafaring people and very warlike. We know about Crete from the travels of the Apostle Paul in Acts, and he speaks about being in Crete and about the Cretans being liars and so forth and so forth. but they were descendants of Ham, and one of the sons of Noah. But God will have his vengeance because of the hatred and of and the wickedness of the Philistines, and eventually they're going to disappear as well. And that is that they ended up in the path of Nebuchadnezzar on his way to Egypt, and they disappeared. Now in chapters 26 through 28. In chapters 26 through 28, God spends his condemnation now of the surrounding countries or city-states. And he speaks about the city of Tyre and also the city of Sidon. He doesn't spend much time talking about Sidon. It was kind of a, I'm not saying a suburb, but it was closely allied and tied with Tyre. Sidon was about 25 miles north of Tyre along the coast. And since Nebuchadnezzar was coming on his way south, Sidon just happened to be in his way, so he just went ahead and took that city fairly easily. But then he comes to Tyre, and he spends 15 years in battle up against Tyre. He is just, he's worked himself half to death just trying to breach the walls of Tyre. And eventually, 15 years later, he did finally get in. Now, of course, when he came down, Tyre was an ancient city, and it was located on the Mediterranean Sea coast. But because of its location, it was a center of trade for thousands of miles around. And you look in, I think it's chapter, chapters 27, talks about all of the riches. It was a center of trade for thousands of miles, not only by land routes, but by sea routes as well. It was comprised of two cities. You had the main city, which was on the rocky shoreline on the mainland, and then you had the smaller part of the city, which was located on a small island about a half a mile out in the Mediterranean offshore. This ideal location with this island out there provided the location of two harbors. One of their main exports we read about was the color purple. Now, it just says the exports was purple, and they extracted that from shellfish, and which was located nearby, and I don't know exactly how they did that. There was a process that they cooked the shellfish, and the purple came out. It was, I guess, dye, but it was so rare that and so valuable that it was only for royalty or very wealthy people for clothing and home furnishings. If you remember in Acts 16, about Lydia of Thyatira, that was the first convert there. Paul and Silas were visiting there. She became a believer, and she welcomed them into her home and lodged Paul and Silas and his group there. And being a seller of such rich wares, she was probably quite a wealthy woman. Exactly what purple was, something that you dyed clothing with, but it was rich looking, it was quite valuable. And Tyre controlled all the trade for thousands of miles and became wealthy beyond measure. And all the merchant caravans that traveled overland had to come through Jerusalem, and they had to pay that toll tax or fee to come through the land. Jerusalem is now destroyed, and so those caravans no longer had to pay those fees. This, of course, gave the merchants of Tyre extra money in their pocket and more bargaining power, and they could buy goods or trade for goods at a cheaper price. Tyre also rejoiced over the fall of Jerusalem simply because of that. We're told by Ezekiel that they reveled in their beauty and their perfection. They gloated about the people they attracted and all they hired mercenaries from throughout the world. This is the first mention we have of Persia. They had mercenaries there in the city of Tyre from Persia. Of course, their greatest sin was pride and their rejoicing over the destruction of Jerusalem. It says that they were wise. The king was wise, even more wise than Daniel of Babylon. At least that's what he thought. The king set himself up as God, and because of that, God declares in Ezekiel chapter 26 that he would scrape her clean, and her wealth would be cast into the sea, and nothing would remain except rocks to dry nets upon. Quite a condemnation by the Lord. And of course, when people looked at that, they probably wondered, how in the world can that happen? But all the supporting towns and villages that surrounded that area would also be destroyed along with her people. God says he'll bring destruction from the north. Well, guess who's from the north? That's the Babylonians. And Nebuchadnezzar came against Tyre, built his siege walls and rams against her. But it took him 15 years to break into Tyre and destroy the city. But they completely destroyed the mainland city. But they were not able to defeat the island part of Tyre. This was left, of course, later on, history tells us that this was left to Alexander the Great, who came along about 200 years later. And it took him 7 months to defeat the city, but kind of interesting because he took the rubble left over by the Babylonians when they destroyed Tyre, and made a causeway out to the island and defeated the inhabitants that way. And so Tyre, the ruler of the seas, would no longer exist. And today, city's not there. Fishermen spread their nets out on the rocks where it was. Interesting, just like the Lord predicted it would happen. But because the king of Tyre thought himself a wise god, his kingdom would be thrown into the sea bottom, and he would die multiple deaths. He was prideful. He saw himself as an impenetrable stronghold in the midst of the sea. But God did humble him and his city. And when he did, it shocked and humbled everyone who had done business with Tyre. It had far-reaching effect, and all the merchants, kings, governors, people in power throughout the world were just shocked that this could possibly happen to Tyre. But it happened, and they thought, wow, you know, if this could happen to Tyre, it can happen to any of us. Wow, you know, God is very, very powerful. And they got the lesson real nice and plain. I put down next week we'd be discussing the fate of Egypt beginning in chapter 33, and that was wrong. God has devoted three chapters, 26, 27, 28, to the destruction and the prophecies against Tyre and Sidon. Actually, the beginning of Egypt and the destruction of Egypt begins in chapter 29 and goes through 32. And that's four chapters. And we'll get started in chapter 29 next week. And we'll take a look about the prophecies against Judah. It was kind of interesting to note because Ezekiel tells us that because it took so long for Tyre to be defeated and destroyed, that everybody that was in Tyre managed to get out with their wealth. And so when Tyre was finally defeated after the 15 years, there wasn't enough wealth there that they could get, that Nebuchadnezzar could get to pay his army. Lots of them were mercenaries, but he never garnered enough wealth. And so what does he do? He turns his eye towards Egypt. And Egypt, of course, was conspiring with Israel to cause the defeat. Nebuchadnezzar had his problems with Egypt before. So we're told that he laid Egypt bare for 40 years. And while Egypt would be repopulated eventually, as we know it today, it would never again be a world power. And so we will get into the prophecies and the destruction of Egypt next week, Lord willing. And we'll go 29, 30, 31, and 32, and all those four chapters. And if you want to peruse those chapters just briefly, then we'll take a look at God's judgment on Egypt. And then in chapter 33, it changes pace, and we'll take a look at that. Kind of interesting because on in Ezekiel the 29th chapter, in verse 1, it's the we even know because Ezekiel's dates were so precise, they can date all these pretty accurately. Ezekiel 29, chapter verse 1, 12th day of the 10th month of the 10th year, July 14th, 588. And that's when Ezekiel talks about this this prophecy. And that's against Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and against him and all Egypt. And then in Ezekiel 29:17, which is 17 verses down the way, it's September 2nd, in the year 572, which is 17 years later on. Later on, 17 years. And then in Ezekiel chapter 30, it goes back to October 5th, 588, back up to when the first prophecy was made. Also in Ezekiel 31, November 27th, 588. And then Ezekiel 32, August 8th, 586. And Ezekiel 32, August 22nd, 586. So they're not always right in line. Some of them refer back to, we see that, there's one 572, which seems like it's out of whack a little bit, but it's really not. The first prophecy comes during the siege of Jerusalem. And that's about the time that Pharaoh's army was coming, coming to rescue Jerusalem. Jeremiah in chapter 37 talks about that. Secular history tells that, the Pharaoh at this particular time was a man named Hophra, and he ruled for 25 years until one of his generals strangled him and took over and replaced him. Secular history, Egyptian history, doesn't mention that violent overthrow. It just speaks of his changing succession of kings. We'll find that Pharaoh Hophra's pride was he believed that his kingdom existed by his own power. But Job says that God will put a hook in his mouth. In other words, God will control him. And fish will stick to his scale. And what that was his people of Egypt would stay with him and they would suffer the same fate that he did. He and his followers would be dragged out into the wilderness, and that's where he would die along with his followers. Pharaoh Hophra went to Libya to help against the rebellion that was going on there, but he lost his fight and his army turned against him. So we'll go there and we'll dig into that just a little bit, and then when it comes to chapter 33. We'll take a little bit more detailed look at that. But we know eventually this was the problem. I'm just reading in Daniel. We know that Nebuchadnezzar set up a statue and demanded that everybody bow down to it. And of course, Daniel and his friends didn't do that, so they ended up in the fiery furnace. So we're going to find that Nebuchadnezzar is going to suffer the same problem that all the rest of these countries had. They set them up. They set themselves up as gods, and the Lord comes along and he's going to set it right. And we know the story about Nebuchadnezzar and spending his time growing long fingernails and eating grass and all that stuff, but that's for some other time. They will get into 29 through 32 next week, Lord willing. Anybody have any questions?
Ron, you mentioned you know, us believing because of some of the things that they've dug up. Can you remember which of the cities it was that where they made God so angry that he said it would never be found?
Well, I think the thing, I know that he, one that, or at least the two that I know of, that I can think of offhand was Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities down there. And They don't know where they're at. They have no idea where those, so they know in the general vicinity, but they've never found the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it also says against the surrounding cities in the area. So it was more than Sodom and Gomorrah. It was several cities altogether. But they've never been found.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, there's a number of them, you know, like Babylon. you know, it was actually about 55 miles out of the Iraqi capital. It's out in the desert. It's just a bunch of rubble out there, remains of a city, but it's never been rebuilt. And God said that that's what he would do to that city. He did a lot of things like that. You know, a lot of the cities disappeared. Sodom and Gomorrah are the two that really come to mind. We know where Tyre was. The rubble is still there. We know where Babylon was. We know, and of course, at one time, I think the reason why Babylon disappeared was the river changed direction and then left Babylon out there in the middle of the desert. And even though this latest ruler that was there in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, tried to rebuild it back to some of its glory, but it didn't work. So anyway, kind of interesting stuff, but we see God's hand in all of this. We can look at it. Now this you're looking at almost 3,000 years ago that this is happening. And we can look at it, we can read it, and we can see what the outcome of it was. We know not only from Bible, but we can see archaeological finds that, and it's kind of interesting. I don't remember who said that. It might have been Dean that said it, but made a comment about archaeologists. The first thing they do when they look to find something is they go to the Bible. And if they want to know about the history of a city or whatnot like this, they go to the Bible, and that's where they start. But even though a lot of them won't admit that the Bible is accurate. So